From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Bloomberg News reports that Kremlin officials are in intense negotiations with their American counterparts in advance of the summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin next week. Predictions for the meeting run the gamut from historic geopolitical shift to overblown photo op. Today, we're getting another perspective and an astonishing life story from a former Cold Warrior. Jack Barsky was a KGB illegal, a Soviet spy posing as an American, beginning in 1978. He dodged orders to return when his cover was compromised more than a decade later, making him the longest surviving member of the elite espionage program depicted in the popular FX series The Americans. Jack is now a U.S. citizen living in a far less intense life in Covington, Georgia, with his wife and youngest daughter. He's the author of the book Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. Jack, welcome.
Yes, thanks for having me. I would like to correct you. Far less intense is not quite accurate. I'm raising a seven-year-old by the name of Trinity, who lives up to her name. So it's quite intense at home.
So the operations still continue.
Oh, you bet. And we are engaged on a daily basis in some undercover operations because a little one has finally gotten a grasp of what it means to be a spy.
So there must be a lot of explaining going on.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, let's go back to the other part of your life. You were born in East Germany, 1949, a really critical time in Europe. What was going on there at the time, especially in Germany?
Well, 1949, it was 4 years after the end of World War II. The Communist Party of the Soviet occupation zone, which eventually became East Germany, was tightening its hold on this country. I was born about 5 months prior to the German Democratic Republic was and came into existence, which was a couple of months after the West Germany became a state. And so that started the 40 years of a divided Germany, East and West. And this was the firing line of the Cold War, East and West Germany and Berlin, of course.
And what was your name, given name?
I hate to say that in the United States, because it sounds unusual and it's difficult to pronounce. But here it goes, Albrecht Dittrich.
Okay, we're going to stick with Jack Barsky. Well, you joined your father was a communist. He was a member of the party.
Yes, he was.
You joined the Young Pioneers, a communist youth organization.
Everybody did.
Well, communists were the victors then, right? They had won against Hitler as far as they were concerned.
As far as we heard, obviously it was an alliance, but it was Stalin and the Red Army that really defeated Hitler. For the most part, this is not exactly wrong. The Soviet Union bore the brunt of the war in the European theater, but without the help from the United States and England, it would have been much more difficult and possibly not as would have taken much longer.
So the picture of history that you learned was very much with a communist slant, or the Russian, pro-Russian slant. What were you taught about life in the West?
Oh, it was all bad. we had, some of us had a glimpse that at least the standard of living in West Germany was much higher. We didn't have any relatives in the West, but there were some very distant relatives who occasionally would send a package with strange food items. Cereal, you know, something we couldn't get in the East. The bottom line was we had a rough idea. By the way, I grew up in an area where you couldn't get Western television. It was called the Valley of the Clueless. So I just didn't know much, and I didn't care much to know about what it was like. All I did know was the evil capitalists, and in West Germany, the successors of the Nazis were operating there and still exploiting the poor working class in the Western countries.
And you were a serious student. You were
Not in the beginning. It took me until about 11th grade when I kicked into gear.
You were studying chemistry, was it, in university?
Well, yeah, as a student. In 11th grade, it was 1 year. And I finished high school with nothing but A's because I wanted to. And then I became really ambitious. And, I was a all-A student in college as well.
When you were identified or approached at first by, East German Stasi, the secret police there, or a KGB recruiter?
That is not quite clear to me. My best friend claims credit for fingering me. He wound up in the Stasi himself. He's still my best friend, by the way. I don't know. I just don't know exactly how that happened, but I do believe that the first person who actually talked to me was a volunteer, German citizen, East German citizen, volunteer for the KGB.
Well, this is a sort of marker throughout. You're kind of kept part in the dark.
Oh,
right?
You bet.
But they played the long game with you. It wasn't, they sort of, let's say, wined and dined you in their equivalent way for a long time. And then asked you to join the KGB. Now, you weren't forced to do it. Is that correct?
No, you can't force somebody into intelligence kind of work, into this kind of dangerous work, particularly into the undercover work. If you try to do that, you're going to have somebody who's going to fail.
Hmm.
You can force somebody who was already in a position where they can give you secrets by extortion, blackmail, whatever. But to get into the game, you don't force.
But you did join the KGB. They fabricated letters to misdirect your mother, saying that you were doing something else, and to your brother. Did you know what you were getting into when you said yes?
I thought I did.
Huh. What were you after?
Fame, travel, and the knowledge that I was doing something very important for the future of the world.
Mm.
So you mix this all together. It was a very, very strong incentive, which by a small margin trumped a very good, which I was pretty certain was going to happen, a very good career in East Germany as a college professor.
I'm speaking with former KGB spy Jack Barsky, who wrote a book, Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. It is the real-life story of spycraft we rarely hear outside of the movies.
Oh, by the way, we haven't been properly introduced, Melina. My name is Bond, James Bond.
You mean it'll be difficult?
Very.
Well, this is not mission difficult, Mr. Ant. It's mission impossible. Difficult should be a walk in the park for you.
That, of course, is some of the images that we get of spycraft. How were you actually trained to be in the KGB?
Well, the images that are in public are 99% wrong.
It's not quite that glamorous?
Not at all. Let me just tell you how this all started. As you indicated previously, that it was a very long game. Just the recruiting itself took about a little over a year. I would meet with my handler off and on, and we would talk about things. He would give me small tasks to do and so forth. But at that point, they had no clue as to whether they were going to eventually recruit me or not.
They were sort of testing you out then.
A very, very long game. And I know in hindsight now that how selective they were. There's a couple of interviews by ex-high level, one of them actually was the head of the KGB, individuals who talked about exactly how this worked and what they were looking for. It's a list of character traits that I said, wow, yeah, that's me. So initially there was no training. There was just an unofficial relationship until one day I was asked rather abruptly. So what, and I, there was a meeting with a senior official in Berlin, are you in or not? And I said, I wasn't prepared for that question. And I was trying to play for time. It wasn't allowed. He said, I want that answer tomorrow.
Hmm.
That was a rather stressful night that I had.
So 24 hours later, you signed up and you were trained for 2 years in East Germany, then submitted for a kind of audition in Russia.
Yeah.
Trained for another 2 years.
Right.
Get your fake passports, your roundabout flights, and eventually you're on your way, a circuitous route to the United States.
But first,
you went from East Germany to West Germany, sort of trying things out. What was that? What was it like to see this place that you'd heard about, this evil capitalist for so long?
Well, it was West Berlin. It wasn't West Germany. And that was standard operating procedure to just try whether the individual you eventually want to send to the West can actually handle the pressure. Because to me, it was enemy territory. And it was very easy for us to get infiltrated into West Berlin because that borderline was guarded only by Russian military. The Americans, British, French, when you crossed over there, did not have somebody on the other side. So I slipped in there, through there, and emerged from a subway tunnel. And I looked it around and said, wow, there's color in the world. Uh-huh. It was a huge dramatic difference between what it felt and looked like to live in East Berlin and West Berlin, because apparently East Germany didn't have enough money or didn't have enough resources to make the paint and paint the building.
So it was just gray and brown?
It was gray and brown, colorless. And even the uniforms of the West Berlin police looked nicer. They were sort of like a light blue, sort of blending in with the rest of the population. But I saw them, of course, because, this was enemy territory, right? And I saw every one of them, and I thought, well, they probably know that I'm not supposed to be here.
Were you trained in surveillance? Is that part of the training, trying to figure out who was where?
At that point, the training was very light. It was really amateurish because it was done by my handler, who wasn't a specialist. Later on in Moscow, the training was as good as it gets. And I was one of the best students. You could not follow me without me figuring out whether you did or not. I know this because we had a lot of exercises and I was pitted against some of the best surveillance teams, and I won the game every time.
Is that still with you, Jack? I mean, that's not something you can lose. Are you always looking over your shoulder or surveying scenes?
No. Wait. See, looking over your shoulder is a no, you don't do that. That's a giveaway. Is it with me? I'm still quite aware of the environment, that's for sure.
My guest is a former KGB spy, Jack Barsky, who's now living in Georgia. He left the agency and was later found by the FBI. These are stories detailed in his book, Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. Now we're going to get his insider views on the upcoming summit between former KGB colonel, now Russian President Vladimir Putin, and President Trump. But first, more on his double life in two countries with, as it turns out, two wives. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Long before Russian hacking and bots fabricating news was good old-fashioned Russian spycraft. It's a life that Jack Barsky knows well. He led a double life as part of the elite Soviet illegals program for 10 years. He ignored the call to return to the USSR and hid out in rural Pennsylvania until being discovered by the FBI in the 1990s. He now lives in the picturesque town of Covington, Georgia. So, Jack, you had to create a backstory for yourself before you came to the U.S. Jack Barsky was the name taken off a gravestone in, what, a Maryland graveyard of a young kid. But what was the rest of that story that, so you could tell people who you were?
Yeah, well, you don't just show up in your early 30s in another country and say, well, here I am. You you got to have at least some idea where you came from. And I had a lot of help to create that story. There were diplomats, you know, half the diplomats in the that operated out of Washington, D.C., and New York were actually KGB. And that hasn't changed that much, by the way. These folks would run around and try to figure out, you know, where I could have lived, gone to school, worked for a while, and so forth. And I got a lot of that material. And based on that material, myself and my handler worked on a cover story that sort of would hang together. I took a lot of my childhood friends with me, so to speak. You know, if I ever had to talk about people in my life, I took them with me, but changed names.
Uh-huh.
Right, so I could talk about somebody real. Interestingly enough, I almost never needed any kind of that detail.
Nobody asked you that? No. Because I think of your accent, you sound a little bit like you're from New Jersey.
New Jersey and some German is in there. But the accent and the residual accent was easy to explain because luckily for me in those days, the maiden name of the person whose identity we stole is Schwartz. And so, essentially, well, you'd sound a little like German. You say, yeah, I spoke a lot of German as a child. And in New York City, that is as credible as it gets because there's a lot of people who were born in, Spanish Harlem, who had a much stronger accent than I did. So, no problem.
So, there are some funny stories about your acclimation. They send you to Canada first, which is kind of America light, I guess.
Right.
And you learned that bottles don't need an opener. Beer bottles have a twist off on them.
That's right. It was just one of many situations where I displayed my cultural unawareness. Culture training was non-existent. I have no idea why, you know, the KGB didn't have a lot of dummies working for them, but they just did not understand that it isn't just the mastery of the language.
Mm.
And sort of the look that you might make you, you know, fit in, but that the culture is very important if you want to pretend to be a citizen of another country.
Well, eventually you were working, you worked as a bike messenger in Chicago, then you were working at MetLife in New York City, huge insurance company, working as a computer programmer.
Yep.
Did you ever run into that? You know, do your colleagues ever think like, what do you mean you don't know who, you know, Jimmy Dorsey is or something like that?
Oh, at that point, I'm a fast learner. And in those days, I was actually able to retain what I learned, which is not as easy anymore. I was, in a sense, and that was unplanned, lucky enough to acclimatize and acquire that cultural knowledge over 2 years while I was working as a bike messenger. You know, I listened a lot and obviously I watched a lot of television, but it was, I was a part of a quote unquote team where nobody really cared where you came from, where you were going, you know, what's your goal in life. You were just there. And so I picked up a lot of this stuff. So when I finally emerged into a professional environment, I was pretty safe. I was certain of myself and there were very, very few false steps. One of them would have been not to have been interested in buying a house and signing up for a 401k and so forth. That was a giveaway, so to speak. But other than that, I felt very, very much as an American and quite functional in that way.
Well, tell us what they were after. I mean, the illegals program was a really fascinating program. Again, we'll play a little clip from the Americans to... This is something, a way it's been dramatized, but training people to live within and among, not necessarily doing, espionage on a grand scale, but just little acts, living a life. What were they after? What did they want you to do when you came over here in 1978?
In order to explain this properly, I have to give you a little bit of history. In the 40s and 50s, the KGB had phenomenal success spying on America, primarily because they had the cooperation of communists American-born communists. Those folks were pretty much instrumental in the theft of the atomic secret. Mm. Now, and then there was the McCarthy period, and the Communist Party was pretty much destroyed. So that avenue to get secrets and get cooperation and so forth, that was gone. So they came up with this grandiose idea, you know, we need to put our own people back in there. And according to somebody who knew, it was Vasily Mitrokhin, who smuggled out, who worked in the KGB archives and smuggled out a tremendous amount of notes over time and shared that with British intelligence. According to him, there were three waves attempting to establish a cadre of illegals in the United States, number one, just in case. Just in case means if there were high tensions between the USSR and the United States, and all the diplomats were to be kicked out, just in case of war, that you had somebody on the other side, you know, behind enemy lines, so to speak. According to Mitrokhin, these three attempts failed miserably. There was sort of probably a romantic notion, you know, we got our own people there, and that's great. And I think it had a lot to do also with reporting up and telling, you know, Stalin or whoever was Khrushchev and so forth, we got people there,
mm-hmm.
right? To me, in hindsight, I think it was kind of foolish. On the other hand, I was not told exactly what they would want us to do in case that happens, you know, the sleeper
in
aspect.
In case there's a total all-out
war. Yes, the sleeper
war.
Aspect of my existence. That was actually the most important piece. I met a fellow agent of mine, East German, who also operated in New York at the same time I did. His task was nothing but be there. I had some secondary tasks.
Well, what did you do at your job at MetLife? What did you have access to that could benefit the Soviets?
Oh, my goodness. I had access to the records of about, the health records of about at least 15 million Americans. And the funny thing is, when I was back in Moscow, I told my bosses, I said, look, I got this. Are you interested? You know, and there were employees of companies that made military equipment, weapons, and so forth, and they passed, not being aware of the importance of data. And there was a lot of backwards thinking then. So I said, okay. My primary contribution, quote unquote, besides this being there, was you know, profiling a lot of people, especially while I was in college, young students that could have been possibly approached and recruited. I was never told whether anybody was talked to or recruited for that matter. And then I did. I performed some tasks that required you to travel outside of the restricted area that the diplomats they couldn't. I think it was 50 miles. But once they were to go 50 miles outside of New York City or Washington, D.C., they had to register with somebody in, you know, the government. And I could travel freely. And I did a couple of those. But altogether, the one thing I know that I didn't do, I never touched anything that was really secret.
Mm-hmm.
I never got close to somebody who had state secrets. Again, you said it was a long game. Over time, you know, with my career, I got closer and closer to that kind of a situation, but thank God I was not with the KGB anymore.
Well, that's what I would love to ask you more about. But first, I want to tell everybody that we're talking with Jack Barsky. He is a former KGB Soviet spy who was living in the United States, planted here to look like an American, living a double life. And that included for you having a wife back in Germany and a wife here in the United States. Now, did they know about your secret life?
The one in Germany did.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't know about the other woman. But that situation wasn't planned. You know, looking back at my entire life, nothing much was ever planned. You know, there's an interesting subtitle I came up with that might be more descriptive of my life. It says, "What in the world happened?" All right, so I was allowed to get married. I loved this woman. She was wonderful. I loved her so much. Yet I didn't love her enough to say to the KGB, "No, I'm done." So that career and the mission came first, and the wife came second. And since she was not,
and they encouraged you to marry her because having a wife back at home,
they allowed me.
I see.
It wasn't encouragement. They actually encouraged others to get married and come over as couples. My wife didn't qualify. She was psychologically not strong enough. So ultimately, it's right. You have an anchor at home, and particularly that we had a child together, that makes it much less likely that you might defect. But, you know, single young man, you have to live a normal life. You can't just, like, be a monk. And so I dated in the U.S., and I met this one lady who was really, quote-unquote, safe because she wasn't American. She just lived here. She was from South America, Guyana. And through some, you know, it so happens that eventually she got pregnant. And the other thing, I married her because she was illegal. And she was looking for somebody, to marry to get the green card. And I took pity on her. I didn't love her. I liked her. I took pity on her. I said, "Okay, let's get married. And after we get the green card, we get divorced." Well, and then something happened. She got pregnant. So now I was in a situation that couldn't have a good outcome.
Right. But you had a daughter, and this was a real hook for you staying here in the U.S. later. But first, I want to get a little bit to this idea of this television series, The Americans. We're going to play a little clip. Here's a scene. This just finished its final seasons. I think it's 6 seasons. Show right. follows 2 KGB illegals, a couple who right. came over under deep cover in Washington, D.C. in the 80s. Now, in this case, the couple has just been tortured by people posing as FBI agents, actually other KGB agents.
"I'm sorry. We had to know if you were the mole, if we could trust you. Untie him."
"If you could trust us?"
"Yes. Very few of us knew about the FBI's encryption codes. You were the first 2. And within a day, the FBI knew. What were we supposed to think?"
So, you know, in the series, of course, you have the music in the background mounting the tension, but there are lots of elaborate disguises, calculated murders, sexpionage going on a lot in this series. Look at all like your life as an illegal?
Not at all. First of all, for instance, this particular scene, and I'm looking back, I was never even trained to defeat a lie detector test. I didn't have weapons training. I didn't have training how to pick a lock. None of that. My weapon was supposed to be my brain, period, nothing else. I was supposed to blend in and not run around in New York City with a wig on my head. Any one of these activities that those 2 illegals were involved in were super high risk, and they would have blown their cover within a few weeks. So it's great entertainment, but it has seeds of reality. For instance, sexpionage. Yeah, that happened. Still does all the time.
So using sex to gain access
or
secrets.
The East German intelligence was famous for doing this. They called them Romeo spies. They sent good-looking young men, agents, to the West, who would then befriend spinsters, middle-aged women who were lonely and who had were maybe secretaries in the government and got lots and lots of secrets through those folks. That happened in reality. But the way it's dramatized in The Americans, very, very little of that is anywhere near the truth.
But you were an extra in The Americans, right?
Yes, I was. And, I hate the picture, the image, because they dressed me in 80s clothes and I had this ugly green jacket. And I says, "That's the stuff we were wearing in those days." But it was fun. It was just to see how this kind of, how the sausage is made. It took a full morning to film a 30-second scene. Amazing.
So there you go again. Television is not quite like reality.
Oh, no.
We're getting the view of a life and espionage from a former KGB spy, Jack Barsky. Stay with us. We're going to get his thoughts on how former KGB agent Vladimir Putin is going to play the Trump-Putin summit in Helsinki next week and also learn how he got out. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. High-rises and condos are being quickly constructed to keep up with Atlanta's soaring demand for housing, and so are rents. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about what rising rents mean for the young professionals the city is hoping to attract, as well as service workers and others who cannot afford to live here. What are some creative ways you or someone you know is using to pay rent? Maybe Airbnb or renting out the spare bedroom? Moving an hour away from work. Let us know. Leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter and on Facebook, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Last week, a Senate Intelligence Committee reportedly backed the conclusion of three U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia tried to help Donald Trump win the 2016 presidential election. Now, Trump told reporters that he will press the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, on election meddling when they come face to face next week, along with some other issues, according to the White House statement.
And the statement said that the two will be discussing relations between the U.S. and Russia. And it also said that they'll be talking about a range of national security issues. Among that, they're likely to touch on topics such as Syria and Ukraine.
Russia analysts peg Putin as a shrewd negotiator with a deep KGB toolkit wielded since his youth. Who better to ask about that than a former KGB operative? Jack Barsky lives in Georgia, in Covington, not the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. His book, Deep Undercover, details a decade spent as a Soviet agent living in the United States and his life since, and he's here with us in the studio. So, Jack, before we get back to your story, European allies are pretty much bracing for this summit. What's your prediction, and how KGB Colonel Vladimir Putin will play it?
All right. Let's, first of all, I got to be really careful not to step out of the sandbox that I have knowledge in, because, you know, it's easy to take on the mantle of expert and come up with all kinds of wild predictions. The media are rife with that because everybody just needs to trump somebody else. I'm sorry for that word. With another story, for instance, the expert that you just quoted as Putin having an arsenal of KGB weapons or whatever you want to call it.
A toolkit is what The Guardian reported.
The Guardian is, I'm sorry, Guardian, and I like you, but you're wrong. Dead wrong. Vladimir Putin was a mid-level bureaucrat in the KGB who spent his active time in service and outside of the Soviet Union in East Germany in a city called Dresden. In Dresden, there was not much action. The action was in Berlin, Vienna, Paris, London, New York. Vladimir Putin was in Dresden. So that's number one. Number two, I actually met his ex-boss. His name is Oleg Kalugin, and he lives still in the United States as a citizen. And he said he was a sort of mediocre. And lastly, we got this picture in the U.S. that, you know, all KGB people are 10 feet tall. I was probably one of the tallest KGB agents, and I'm 6'3". All of that is BS. I'm sorry. What Putin is good at, number one, he is a master at understanding the Russian psyche. He's been playing the Russian psyche to a point where he's getting reelected by 70-75% of the vote, and these are pretty realistic votes. And apparently, he's an extremely shrewd politician. That's what makes him an adversary, and I don't want to use the word enemy because we don't want to escalate that. Makes him such a dangerous adversary. And from that perspective, I believe in a one-on-one confrontation, discussion, he has the upper hand over Donald Trump because he's been living in this world for fundamentally his entire life, and Donald Trump is still a novice, an amateur. That's why I never thought it was a good idea to have these two one-on-one with just a translator.
How about you? Do you feel like, you know, you were an effective spy? You said that you and Vladimir Putin, he was a bureaucrat. You, however, were in another realm, coding and encrypting messages on a weekly basis, sending things out. Do you think that you were actually providing anything very useful about the Carter or Reagan administrations to the Soviets?
Not inside information. With regard to as to what was useful or not, this is the one question I get a lot, obviously, and I have a hard time answering because you were never told. You know, I did what I did, and I did get at one point, one year prior to my quitting the service, I got the second highest decoration of the Soviet Union. So somebody must have thought I'd provided something of value. Whatever it was, I will never know.
Well, let's get to that fateful day. This is December 1988. You're living in New York City, working for MetLife. You got a sign you'd been compromised. What was that sign?
Well, it was this fist-sized red dot on a prearranged spot. That was a signal. I would pass that spot every day on my way to work. It was a signal spot where diplomat agents could post a signal. For instance, call me to a meeting or call me to a dead drop operation or something else. I forgot, but the red dot was the danger sign. That was, it said, extreme danger, get out. Don't ask any questions, don't even go home. Well, it wasn't quite that simple. You had to get some money, but it was for me to leave.
So you were looking for the spot every single day, and suddenly
one day it appeared.
And it triggers what? That you're getting out of there, you got to go get up, you know, somewhere, what, Canada,
no,
get a passport?
It triggered numbness because I had, you know, at the time I had an 18-month-old daughter, and I had fallen in love with this child, and I had for months and months tried to figure out what to do if and when my service ends and I have to go back. How do I support this child? How do I make sure that she has a decent life? And so when I saw this spot, I just ignored it. I just went on to work, and obviously it was hanging over me. But now, you know, I was running out of time, but I still had some, you know, leeway. I still could play for some time for a few weeks, and maybe I would come up with something that would, like, you know, some inspiration of genius would give me a solution. I was also not, at that point, I'd lived in the U.S. for 10 years, and I was not convinced that I really was in danger because I was always checking myself. I always looked for whether I was being surveilled. I had signs in my apartment that would indicate to me that somebody was actually in there, doing a search. None of that. There was no signs whatsoever. So I didn't quite believe that sign either.
So you ignored it. Did anybody approach you?
Yes. Eventually, you know, I could ignore it only that so long. And they didn't, obviously, they didn't know, for instance, whether I had read the sign, whether I had listened to the subsequent radio transmission. I could have been in a hospital. I could have died already. So they were actually now looking for me. They knew the way I went to work because I had to tell them that. And one day I was approached on a subway platform, and it was the only time when I had direct physical contact with another agent who, you know, came up to me. It was early in the morning. It was still like twilight. And he whispered in my ears, and I will never forget those words, "You got to come home or else you're dead." Interesting choice of words.
There's kind of no two ways about that.
So the numbness increased significantly, but I still went on to work.
But you had a young daughter, as you said. You know, maybe the marriage was not all that you thought it would be, but you had this young daughter and you decided to stay. So what did you tell the KGB in order for them to stop tracking you?
Well, maybe that was the stroke of genius I was looking for. How do you disentangle yourself from that world? It's a world that's full of lies, deception. You never know who's telling you the truth. You were introduced. Somebody introduces them, another agent, themselves by name, and you know it's not your real name, their real name, and so forth. So I came up with the grand lie that even worked to pretty much deceive the liars. And I told them I had contracted HIV/AIDS. And that was so forcing that they absolutely believed it without double checking, because there was no good reason for me to stay. They didn't know that I had a child.
Mm. So this is the late 1980s,
yes,
AIDS epidemic, full-blown.
AIDS was a death sentence. There was no reason for me to say I'm not coming home, because they knew back there I had savings, dollar savings, a phenomenal amount of savings. They were going to give me a house. I mean, I would have went home and gotten a hero's welcome. It makes no sense for this man to say, you know, come up with a lie. It had to be the truth.
So you lived in the small village in Pennsylvania, what, until the 90s?
Right.
Unbeknownst to you, the FBI was investigating you for three years.
For quite some time.
Buying a house next door.
Right.
Posing as bird watchers in your neighborhood.
Right.
Very interesting story, however, what led them to you. You mentioned this man before.
Matrokin.
He had been keeping an archive of the KGB. How did he bring that to the FBI's attention?
Well, he contacted the CIA, who didn't believe him, and then he went to MI5, British intelligence, and they said, "Come on in, chap, let's have some tea." And he unloaded a couple of suitcases full of notes.
Handwritten, right?
They were originally handwritten. He typed them up in his dacha. And eventually those notes made it to the FBI, and the name Jack Barsky and some other information about Jack Barsky was part of that. And that triggered the investigation. According to my good friend Joe Riley, who led the investigation, this was the number one counterintelligence case for the FBI for a couple of years.
Well, so Joe Riley comes and finds you. And you exchanged information for citizenship. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you can put it that way.
And then Joe Riley becomes your good friend.
Yes, and he still is. We played over 100 rounds of golf together. We got to know and like each other. He wrote the afterword for my book as well. So, and it was a very, very good feeling when to read a sentence. His last sentence is, "And quite frankly, this country could use a few more people like Jack Barsky." So sort of I've come full circle, and this truly is my home now. And so is Georgia, by the way.
Well, for you, after living this double life, you know, knowing that you had a wife and a son back in Germany, having this daughter that you loved here in the U.S., and eventually meeting a woman and marrying her and having another child, how did it feel keeping these identities separate to have this suddenly blown? Was it a relief?
Well, the yes, absolutely. But it was really a relief to, when I was interrogated for weeks and weeks, it was a relief to just dump everything because I had kept everything bottled up, right? It was even a bigger relief when I, through no fault of my own, I was discovered by the media when I went public on 60 Minutes and I was able to write my book and subsequently visit Germany and put all the pieces of my life together. I feel like Humpty Dumpty has been glued together, not seamlessly, you can see the seams, but I feel more like I have healed a lot. And I'm such a lucky person to be able to do all this because normally a life like mine does not end well.
Well, what about your neighbors? I mean, what about people who'd known you for years suddenly discover that you have this other identity? Your wife discovers you have this other identity. How do you explain that?
Well, big surprise. I know that when 60 Minutes came out, the in the company where I had a very prominent position, pretty much not much work got done that Monday. But you know, the good thing for me is now I don't have to tell everybody. I mean, the story's out and I have to remember who I told what and all this. It's, I'm really glad that, you know, I'm sort of normal to the extent you can be normal. See, the thing is, once you've been in this world, you're never going to get quite rid of it. And I can talk about that for another hour. But it's almost like when you go to the beach and you spend a week at the beach and that damn sand is still with you a year after. And so that sand of undercover and a secret world, it doesn't quite leave you in light of the attacks that with his Novichok agent in Britain and all that stuff.
You hear those stories.
There's
and you
always
must
something
think.
And you always there's always some worry.
So if you were to approach that, 29-year-old Albrecht at his dorm room and he was challenged with this, or he was asked, will you join the KGB? Will you do this mission, this secret work for the good of the world? What would you tell him?
I would say, heck no, don't even think about it. I was actually asked by an American about maybe getting into the CIA and participating in what's called black ops, sort of undercover operations. And I said to him, you have to really, really think very hard about it because your moral values may at one point be in conflict of what your government wants you to do. It is a very difficult kind of a decision. And you, no matter what cause you're serving, if it's a just cause, you will come out damaged. There's no way that you come out whole because, you know, this pretend life, it's not like an actor who's on stage and then goes home. You live a different life, and that's harmful to your psyche.
Jack Barsky, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much. We have more on Jack Barsky's book, Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America at gpbnews.org.